Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
It is March 3rd. March has come in like a lion. I'm hoping that it holds up its bargain for the other end. And we are at Judges 17. We finished the Samson story last week, and it's time to move into the conclusion of the book of Judges. Don't let your heart start racing there. Conclusion doesn't mean we're going to finish the book today or next week. We won't. Judges, you might recall, has a double introduction. In chapters 1 and 2, describing the last words of Joshua and the attempt to take the land, but seen from a couple different points of view, where we saw increasing defeats as the roster of the tribes was listed, and some tribes had quite a bit of trouble conquering the Canaanites. In parallel to those double introductions, Judges has a double conclusion. The first is in chapters 17 and 18 that we're going to at least begin to look at today. And the other is chapters 19, 20, 21. There are some interesting distinctives to this section of the book. Some that they share in common with the introductions. For example, there is no foreign oppressor identified in these last five chapters. And there are no judges named or described. And as we get into those stories, in a way, my reaction to that there are no judges listed here is more's the pity. Because they could have used one. This is the section of the book where more than anywhere else we see this repeating phrase, in those days Israel had no king, everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And we're going to find even more significance to that phrase to this morning than we've seen up to now. Just in terms of an interesting literary twist, the author holds one really important piece of information to the very end in one of these stories. And there's also not a lot of editorial comment. It's a history, that's understandable, but there's so much packed in that the lack of editorial comment is almost challenging. And what I mean by that is simply this. There is so much going wrong that it's easy to miss just how many problems there are in these stories. Some of them are obvious. Some of them are not so obvious. And we really have to refer back frequently to especially Deuteronomy in order to understand what's happening. Because the author will not always point out that this was a sin or that this was a violation of the law. So we'll try to find those as we go along. In many respects, both of these stories remind me of a story from my own youth. I'm the foil of this story, so I'm not telling it against anyone but myself. When I was 12 years old, my older brother and I, he was 15, were ushering at our oldest sister's wedding. And I was nervous, and I was self-conscious because I was 12, and I was trying to do a really good job for my sister and for my own self-esteem. And because that was probably the peak of the level of competition between my brother and me on a daily basis. And the service was about ready to start. The procession was about ready to begin. People were generally in. And this one slightly older gentleman stepped in the door alone. And my brother had just seated someone, so he was on his way back. And so I stepped up to do my usherly duty, and I said, "Friend of the bride or the groom?" And the gentleman looked across the sanctuary with a little bit of a scowl on his face, and he said, actually, I don't like either one all that much. Well, I was flummoxed. I had no idea what to do. I had no idea what to say. And I just stood there and maybe stammered for a second. And then past him, on the other side of the back of the sanctuary, I spied my brother laughing like an idiot. And I realized that I was being had. It wasn't planned, it was spontaneous, but the gentleman turned out to be the photographer. He wasn't a guest at the wedding at all. When we come into these stories in Judges, it's natural to look for who was the hero and who was the villain, because that is normal literary structure. But just like the question, friend of the bride or the groom, there's really no one here to like. There is no hero for the rest of Judges. There is no hero. These are just depressing stories about when villains interact with the villains. We've seen a little bit of that already back in the story of Abimelech and the mercenaries who came into town and thought that they could push him out and take over themselves. Nobody here is doing what they're supposed to. Nobody. So if you're looking in these stories and trying to figure out who's the good guy, don't bother. No good guys. So the first story in chapter 17 and 18 basically has three characters. It's a three-actor play, if you will. One of them is a man named Micah, not to be confused with the prophet who would come centuries later. And Micah is the first character we're introduced to, and he lives in the hill country of Ephraim. Ephraim, left center of the map. The western part of it is plains, the eastern part of it is the hill country, and that's where he lives. The second character is a young Levite who's down on his luck. And he and Micah will have some interactions before we meet the third character. And the third character is not just a person. The third character is basically the tribe of Dan, or at least a piece of Dan, 600 Danites who are looking for a home. And it's the interaction among these three that makes up this story. So let's go in and have a look, and we can make some comments as we go. Judges chapter 17. Verse 1. I have no idea how far we'll get today. We will do what we do. There was a man of the hill country of Ephraim whose name was Micah. I already gave that much away. And he said to his mother, "The 1,100 pieces of silver that were stolen from you, about which you uttered a curse and also spoke it into my ears, behold, the silver is with me. I took it." Okay, so now we know that Micah lives in the hill country of Ephraim and that Micah is a thief and would even stoop so low as to steal from his own mother. What a guy. And 1,100 pieces of silver is nothing to sneeze at. And it almost sounds like the reason he's fessing up is the curse. But we can't be sure. But he does make a point of saying, the curse that you spoke into my ear. Maybe she suspected him. I don't know. In any case. And his mother said, blessed be my son by the Lord. So she's a forgiving sort of parent. She appreciates that she's getting her money back. And he restored the 1,100 pieces of silver to his mother. So, okay, nice, quick, bare bones story, but at least we have a happy ending, right? Nah, not right. He restored the 1,100 pieces of silver to his mother in verse 3, and his mother said, I dedicate the silver to the Lord. Which still sounds like a nice, happy ending. I dedicate the silver to the Lord from my hand for my son to make a carved image and a metal image. Now, therefore, I will restore it to you. So when he restored the money to his mother took 200 pieces of the silver and gave it to the silversmith, who made it into a carved image and a metal image. And it was in the house of Micah. Mom is so overjoyed that her son has come clean that she decides to dedicate a portion of this money to the Lord. But her idea of dedicating a portion of money to the Lord is to have that portion made into idols. A carved image and a metal image. And if you take a look back, which we don't need to do right here and now, because I think you all know this verse at least in general, but in Deuteronomy 27:15, the exact same words are used, that Israel is not to make any carved images. And Israel is not to make any metal images. It is expressly forbidden. And yet it is exactly what she decides to do with this money that she is, quote unquote, dedicating to the Lord. And verse 4 ends with, and it was in the house of Micah. And the man Micah had a shrine. That's okay, though, isn't it? No, it's not. Where is Yahweh supposed to be worshipped? At the tabernacle. By the way, where is the tabernacle? Don't be shy. Shiloh. And where is Shiloh? In the hill country of Ephraim. Micah does not live far from the tabernacle at all. And yet, he's ignoring the proper worship of Yahweh. It is important that this is happening in the hill country of Ephraim, here at the beginning of the story. So Micah has a shrine, and we've seen this before, he made an ephod. Not supposed to do that. That's for the high priest. We saw Gideon make that mistake. And he had household gods. These would have been little carved metal. Old King James language, thou shalt not make unto thee any graven images. These are little images that would have been around the house, customized. Scholars argue over whether he was really worshiping false gods or whether he was just worshiping Yahweh in an improper manner. It doesn't really make any difference. The problem is the same either way. Yes, Kyle.
This just reminds me of one of the arguments I heard people say, well, the archaeological evidence shows that a lot of these people in, you know, Israel, they did things like this, but, you know, when you read here, it's not being cast in a positive light. It's not like it's saying this doesn't happen, it's just that it's not supposed to be happening, and it happens anyway, so it's just, I thought of it, it's a funny instance where the actual, if you think about it, the archaeological evidence kind of shows what the whole story of the book of Judges, you know, does come to play. You know?
Yeah, yeah. There are people today who say, well, you Christians, you know, you do just as many bad things as anybody else, and they try to dismiss the reality of Christian faith that way. This is the archaeological equivalent. They find all these places where the Israelites clearly had these multiple gods and shrines and images and idols, and so they say, well, you can't believe the Old Testament. Israel wasn't really monotheistic. Well, they were supposed to be. And we're supposed to avoid sin, but it demonstrates the problem. It doesn't negate the truth. And Micah has all this stuff that he's not supposed to have, and he has enough of it that apparently he thinks he needs a priest for his own little household worship center. And so verse 5 also tells us that he ordained, I wish that were in quotes, that he ordained one of his sons who became his priest. I'm already starting to worry about whether my red pen is going to run out of ink as I mark up all the things that are going wrong in this story. He lives in the hill country of Ephraim. Presumably he is an Ephraimite. He can't ordain, and his son can't be a priest. Under the Torah, only Levites can serve in that capacity. So this is just a mess. And the whole point here is to demonstrate just how far astray Israel drifted. Drifted sounds like they just got caught in a bad current. No, wandered, sprinted. Israel moved far away from everything they had been taught when they came into the land. And by the way, we will see clues as we go along here. But remember that I told you that Judges is not linear. It is arranged thematically to show things getting worse and worse. And there's a lot of linear chronology in it, but there are places that aren't this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened. And we are at one of those spots. This story happens relatively early in Israel's time in the land, relatively early in the time span of 300, 350 years that Judges lies across. So we've backed up now. This is not right after Samson, even though Samson was the previous story. This is actually a good ways before Samson. But the author is making a point thematically that leads him to arrange things the way he does and show how Israel could get incredibly bad. As I said, we'll see those clues soon enough. And then we have that wonderful statement in verse 6, and we're going to see it again. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. That's a pretty appropriate capstone to this description of the Ephraimite Micah, doing what is right in his own eyes. It's okay if I worship Yahweh the wrong way. It's okay if I make carved images. It's okay if I have a mantle covered with household gods. It's okay if I ordain my own son and have my own priest for my own little worship center here. Nothing wrong with that. It all seems right in his eyes, and so it's what he does. And since we've brought that statement up, I want to take a look back at something else, and this time I will ask you to turn with me to Deuteronomy. It's just two books back, chapter 12. And we'll start at verse 8. We're speaking to them just as they are going into the promised land. Yahweh says to the people of Israel, "You shall not do according to all that we are doing here today, everyone doing whatever is right in his own eyes." So they're expressly warned not to do this. This phrase in Judges is not just a phrase in Judges. It ties directly back to something that God told them in Deuteronomy. And it gets even better if you go down in chapter 12 to verse 28. There are various and sundry commands given in between about the blood of offerings and holy things that have to be provided. And then it gets to verse 28. "Be careful to obey all these words that I command you, that it may go well with you and with your children after you forever, when you do what is good and right in Yahweh's eyes." So now we see a new level of significance to this repeating phrase in Judges, that everyone did what was right in his own eyes. It is set up in direct contrast to the words of God in Deuteronomy, "You all need to do what is right in my eyes." But instead, Israel is doing what is right in their own eyes, which means that they are putting themselves in the place of Yahweh, and it's the Garden of Eden all over again, where they're setting themselves up to be their own gods. "Thank you very much. Don't need you, Lord." There's much more significance to that phrase than we've recognized in it before. All right. So back to Judges. That was verse 6. And now we're introduced to the next character. "Now there was a young man of Bethlehem in Judah, of the family of Judah, who was a Levite." So it's not that he was of the tribe of Judah. It's that he was in Bethlehem, which is of the tribe of Judah. But he is a Levite, and he sojourned there in Bethlehem. Now, quick question. Why would he sojourn in Bethlehem or anywhere else as opposed to being in the territory that's allotted to his own tribe?
Levites didn't have territory.
That's right. It's a trick question. There was no land allotted to the tribe of Levi. They didn't get land. There were certain cities that were appointed for them and the fields around those cities for farming, but the Levites did not have their own tribal territory. They served as priests, and the people were responsible to see to the needs of the Levites. Those cities were part of it, but the people were responsible to take care of the needs of the Levites. In fact, Deuteronomy 12, again, don't bother turning, verse 19, "Be careful not to overlook the Levites for as long as you live in the land." So here we have this young Levite. We're not told his name, but he has been sojourning in Bethlehem, And he departed from the town of Bethlehem in Judah to sojourn where he could find a place. And as he journeyed, he came to the hill country of Ephraim. Possibly he's headed to Shiloh to see if he can find work at headquarters, so to speak. But he comes to the house of Micah. And Micah said to him, "Where do you come from?" And he said, "I'm a Levite of Bethlehem in Judah, and I'm going to sojourn where I may find a place." Which basically is saying, "I'm looking for work." Which should not happen to a Levite in Israel. But this guy's apparently unemployed. Not hard to believe. If there are more people like Micah who are ignoring the proper worship of Yahweh, it's quite possible that there would be Levites who don't have as much as they should have to do. Verse 10, and Micah sees a golden opportunity. No, that's not what the text says. That's just me editorializing. Maybe I could say, and Micah sees a golden calf opportunity, but I won't say that. And Micah said to him, "Stay with me and be to me a father and a priest, and I will give you 10 pieces of silver a year and a suit of clothes and your living," which would presumably mean room and board. And the Levite went in. So now Micah has a chance to do this even better. It doesn't have to be my son who's a priest. I can actually have a Levite. This will really validate what I'm doing. This is great. This is going to be a feather in my cap. This is going to look so good. And he apparently has the income to do it. I mean, how hard can it be? All he needs to do is melt down one of those little trinkets on the mantle, right? But there's no way that this young Levite should be going in to accept this job. There is no way. The way Micah has this set up is not hidden from him. It's not the proper worship of Yahweh. It is almost certainly not just worship of Yahweh, but idolatry toward other gods, false gods as well. Everything about this is wrong. Everything about this is wrong. And yet this Levite says, "Yeah, I'll take the job." It's a discredit to him as an individual. It's a discredit to Israel that they've put a Levite into this kind of position. There are no heroes in this story. And the Levite was content to dwell with the man. And the young man became to him like one of his sons. And Micah ordained the Levite, face palm, Micah can't ordain. The Levite should know it, even if Micah doesn't. And there we are. Micah ordained the Levite, and the young man became his priest and was in the house of Micah. Then Micah said, "Now I know that the Lord will prosper me, because I have a Levite as priest." I don't even know what to say. He seems to actually believe that this is a good thing he's done. He seems to actually believe that what he's doing is okay. Well, of course he does. He's doing what is right in his own eyes. I know, right? So That's the interaction between Micah and this young Levite. And it's just sad and tragic from stem to stern. Yes?
So I don't remember how many Levites there were.
14.
14?
I'm kidding. Go ahead.
That sounds pretty small. If I don't even remember if there's a place somewhere in the scriptures where it says that they would be dispersed to certain areas. I don't remember and recall how they would apportion them to the tribes of Israel. They seem to have a lot of numbers. So I'm thinking they would go to the bigger tribes, more Levites would go to those areas and try to do ministry all over the place.
Presumably, yes.
Okay. So they just kind of wandered around until they went to a town and thought, okay, here's a place that doesn't have a Levite. Great, I'll settle here and they all went there.
I don't know the answer to that. I mean, were they traveling sorts of priests, or were they assigned? But this young Levite just finds that there's not any support for him in Bethlehem, even though that's where he was assigned. I don't know the answer.
Can we assume that they carried the Torah with them by that point?
I don't know the answer to that either. Can we assume they're carrying the Torah? That's an awful lot of copies of the Torah.
Yeah.
In a culture that can only reproduce those scrolls slowly. So I'm going to say I doubt it. I doubt that they all have copies of the Torah. Yes, Elmer?
What's the name of the belief that each of us is a god, and whatever we do is right because we're a god, if we do it, then it's right? And
what's the formal theological term for seeing oneself as a god?
Yeah, I thought that was one of the myths of the early church, that there was one branch of thought that there was a real god on earth.
I don't know the answer to your question. I mean, I can think of things that would be good words for it, but I don't know historically that there is one.
Right, wrong,
yeah. Sin comes to mind. And that's not one of the prominent historic heresies that the early church dealt with. In terms of an organized system, that's not one of the heresies that the early church dealt with. This is more of a constant problem throughout the history of fallen humanity. So I don't know how to answer your question. It doesn't connect with anything I can think of in church history per se. Are there any other questions that I can't answer?
I'm just thinking the fact that he does all of this stuff in Micah's house may say something more to why he doesn't have a job. He's obviously not a business trader.
He probably had a bad marriage too.
It's a fair point taken in and of its on its own, Ed, but with all the other things that are going wrong with every character in this story. Yeah, it's, I think, telling us a broader truth in the society.
It almost sounds like the political system is broken down if they're just wandering with no kind of control of direction at all.
If you got a man like Micah who's living that close to the tabernacle but has decided he's going to do his own thing with his own religion and his own, yes, I would say the system has broken down.
That was my question, concerning how it would be easy. How many years passed since Deuteronomy, when this happened? And if they're living in the hill country, granted they're close to Shiloh, but still, you're out in the hill country, maybe you're not so close. And if they don't have someone who's got scripture with them, or maybe they've memorized it, that culture, they were pretty good at memorization. I'm just trying to figure out what happened there. And it would be really easy if 100 years passed by, a few generations, and it can be lost so quickly.
Well, there's no question that Judges describes things being lost pretty quickly. But what happened here is simply what happens throughout Judges, that Israel accommodates to the cultures and the religions around them and turns their back on God. And Micah is an individual example. And at some point, the how doesn't matter nearly as much as the what. Whatever his reasons, however much sense they make to him.
You know, the word of God is so powerful, that's, I guess, what I'm saying is if the word was proclaimed at all, you know, you'd think they would repent and say, hey, we're not doing the right things.
Well, they did a pretty good job of proclaiming it there in the valley between the mountains at the end of Deuteronomy, and that didn't stick. So other proclamations may not be sticking either, but I understand your point, and I think it's a good one. It may not simply be that the Israelites are turning their backs on everything that the Levites are proclaiming. It may be that the Levites are falling down on their job too. And the erosion is across all the tribes, including the one that's made up of priests.
Well, Numbers 35:6 and following kind of outline the cities of refuge. They're supposed to be the Levites.
Yeah.
They don't say where they were, but they just listed them. They had six of them. So they had, at some point, they had common, I don't know what word I'm looking for, common ground they came out from, the city they came from. It sounds like it's corroded, you know, no longer true.
Well, I'm sure the cities are still there, but are the Levites doing their job as fully as they should? Yeah. So, yeah. Oh, that's not a hand. Okay. That's just parenting. So the Levite is now in the house of Micah with all of Micah's household gods and Micah's ephod, serving as Micah's priests. And now we meet the third character in this story. And it takes a minute for it to connect back to the first two. But this is in chapter 18, verse 1. In those days, there was no king in Israel. And in those days, the tribe of the people of Dan was seeking for itself an inheritance to dwell in. For until then, no inheritance among the tribes of Israel had fallen to them. Take a look at this map up here. I pointed out Ephraim to the left center. Dan is this ribbon right below Ephraim and above Judah Benjamin. So Dan has this oddly shaped serpentine strip of land allotted to them. But it says that until this time, no inheritance among the tribes of Israel had fallen to them. Do you remember back in chapters 1 and 2 when they described the conquest? How Judah had a great deal of success, for example. But as you moved farther north, it was harder and harder, and you had tribes that couldn't drive them out and so allowed them to live among the Israelites. And then that subtle turn where you had tribes that couldn't drive them out and not allow the Canaanites to live among them, but they lived among the Canaanites. And then you had Dan. And the tribe of Dan, understand Israel occupied from east toward west, so the tribe of Dan is in the hill country of Dan, and they want to drive west and take the flatter, lower, and much more farmable land, and they can't do it. The Canaanites there were keeping the Danites contained in the hill country. Dan was not able to expand and take the lower lands. That was expressly told to us in Judges 1 and 2, that the Danites just couldn't do it. They were not successful in pressing forward. They were apparently having more trouble than any other tribe in taking the land that God has had apportioned to them. So, of course, what else would you do if you're having trouble doing what God has clearly stated is his will for you? Of course you give up and try to find your own way to do something like it, right? No, not right. But it is what the Danites do, at least part of them. at least part of them. Verse 2, so the people of Dan sent 5 able men from the whole number of their tribe, from Zorah and from Eshtaol. If those names ring a bell, they're from the story of Samson. He was from a place between those. To spy out the land and to explore it. And they said to them, go and explore the land. And they're not just saying, go down into the lowlands of our apportionment and scout out the land. No, 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 no. They're sending them across the borders. And they came to the hill country of Ephraim. So they've gone north. And not only did they come to the hill country of Ephraim, but they came to the house of Micah. And they lodged there, these 5 spies. Now, again, more red ink. Here are 5 spies from Dan who have been sent to spy out possible locations in the other tribal territories. This is not right. Not only are they ignoring the place God said is for them, but they apparently are looking for opportunities to grab land from one of their fellow tribes. So they stay with Micah. When they were by the house of Micah, they recognized the voice of the young Levite. Does any of your Bibles say that differently? Anybody have another translation? I'm in 18:3. It doesn't mean that they knew him. Hey, that sounds like Benjamin. Or that sounds like Sam. No, they recognized his, probably, accent. Or it may be that they recognized that he was a Levite because he was doing some kind of his priestly duties. And it was the content of his words that made them recognize that he was a Levite. It doesn't mean they knew him personally. And they turned aside and said to him, who brought you here? What are you doing in this place? What is your business here? And he said to them, this is how Micah dealt with me. He has hired me and I have become his priest. And they said to him, inquire of God, please, that we may know whether the journey on which we are setting out will succeed. So they're looking for some divine guidance or reassurance, even if it comes from somebody who is not in the priestly position he should be. And this young Levite says to them, maybe after prayer, consideration, meditation, or maybe right off the cuff, we have no way to tell. But the priest said to them, go in peace. The journey on which you go is under the eye of the Lord. Which, frankly, it probably isn't. Then the 5 men departed and came to Laish and saw the people who were there, how they lived in security after the manner of the Sidonians, quiet and unsuspecting, lacking nothing that is in the earth and possessing wealth, and how they were far from the Sidonians and had no dealings with anyone. Let me just stop there for a moment. The Sidonians, people from Sidon. Anybody know offhand where Sidon is? It's on the coast. It's not on the coast of this map. Here's the full map of Israel where everything is too small to read. But I want you to appreciate what's going on. You see Ephraim there, right where we were looking at it before, and Dan right below it. go across the Jordan to the red and orange territories and go all the way up from Reuben through Gad through East Manasseh, way up to the top, and what do you see? Dan. What is Dan doing listed up there? That's Laish. That is how far they have gone from their tribal allotment. They are way up north, north of the Sea of Galilee, north of the Lake Hula. They're the headwaters of one of the rivers that feeds down. So yeah, it would be good land. They are about as far north as they can be. They are on the northern frontier. And I wouldn't take the borders of the maps as hard and fast truth, because the descriptions of how the land is laid out in the allotments sometimes refers to features of geography that we're not 100% sure of. But here's the issue. Well, actually, I'll hold that issue. Let me zoom in on the north so you can see better. There's Dan. You can see it as a large print region, and you can see it right above that as a city. But that is, at this point, as we're reading, the city of Laish. Right there at the headwaters of that river that heads south. East of Naphtali, about as far north as you can get, and still be in Israel. Maybe. And if you compare it to Sidon, which is way up at the northern edge of the map on the coast, yeah, that's a bit of a distance, with at least one ridge of mountains between. So yeah, they are isolated from their fellow Sidonians. So we're at verse 8. And when they came to their brothers at Zorah and Eshtaol, which is way back down in the original intended territory for Dan, their brothers said to them, "What do you report?" They said, "Arise, let us go up against them, for we have seen the land, and behold, it is very good. And will you do nothing? Do not be slow to go, to enter in and possess the land. As soon as you go, you will come to an unsuspecting people. The land is spacious, for God has given it into your hands." Why would they say that? Because the Levite told them that this had God's blessing. "A place where there is no lack of anything that is in the earth. So, 600 men of the tribe of Dan, armed with weapons of war, set out from Zorah and Eshtaol, and went up and encamped at Kiriath Jearim in Judah." So when it says they went up, it doesn't mean north. It means they went up in terms of elevation. Oops, I'm going the wrong way here. I just want to back up to the bigger map. They're really headed east. And then they're probably going to go up the Jordan Valley. That would be by far the simplest way to get there. "And they passed on from there to the hill country of Ephraim and came to the house of Micah. Then the five men who had gone to scout out the country of Laish said to their brothers, 'Hey, you know what? Do you know that in these houses there's an ephod, household gods, a carved image and a metal image? Now, therefore, consider what you will do.' And there they turned aside and came to the house of the young Levite at the home of Micah and asked him about his welfare." Hey, good to see you again. How's it going? "Now the 600 men of the Danites, armed with their weapons of war, stood by the entrance of the gate. And the five men who had gone to scout out the land went up and entered and took the carved image, the ephod, the household gods, and the metal image, while the priests stood by the entrance of the gate with the 600 men armed with weapons of war. 600 men with swords and spears is a reasonable distraction. And when these went into Micah's house and took the carved image, the ephod, the household gods, and the metal image, the priest said to them, "What are you doing?" And they said to him, "Shh, keep quiet. Put your hand on your mouth," and which I'm sure is idiomatic for just the same thing, "and come with us and be to us a father and a priest. Is it better for you to be priest to the house of one man or to be priest to a tribe and clan in Israel?" And the priest's heart was glad. He took the ephod and the household gods and the carved image and went along with the people. So he's got a chance to have a nice little promotion here. He gets to be priest not just to Micah and his family, but he gets to be priest to 600 Danites and their families and wherever they establish themselves up north here. This is a nice job transfer on the surface. It's just the same idolatry with better stature. So they turned and departed, putting the little ones and the livestock and the goods in front of them. Now, why would they do that? Why would it mention that they did that? First of all, it tells us that it's not just 600 armed Danite men. They have little ones with them. In other words, they have their families. They really are planning to go up there and resettle. So they have their families, and they have their livestock, and they have their possessions. And they put all of that stuff out in front, which means that the armed men bring up the rear of the caravan. Why?
They probably assumed they'd be pursued.
Yeah. The young Levite slash priest saw what they were doing and asked about it, but Micah doesn't know what they've done yet. And when he finds out, and sure enough, the very next verse, 22, when they had gone a distance from the home of Micah, the men who were in the houses near Micah's house were called out. And they overtook the people of Dan, and they shouted to the people of Dan, who turned around and said to Micah, "What's your problem? What is the matter with you that you come with such a company?" And he said, "You take my gods that I made," he's proud of that, "and the priest," I almost want to add in for myself, "that I ordained, and go away, and what have I left? What do I have left? How then do you ask me, what's the matter with you?" That's what's the matter with me. You took everything. Verse 25, "And the people of Dan said to him, 'Do not let your voice be heard among us, lest angry fellows fall upon you, and you lose your life, along with the lives of your household.' Then the people of Dan went their way, and when Micah saw that they were too strong for him, he turned and went back to his house." Didn't turn out quite as well as he thought when he got himself a Levite to be his family priest. So now the story moves north with this group of Danites. But the people of Dan took what Micah had made and the priest who belonged to him, and they came to Laish. And I'm going to go back to that map of the north. And they came to Laish, to a people quiet and unsuspecting, and struck them with the edge of the sword, and burned the city with fire. And there was no deliverer, because it was far from Sidon, and they had no dealings with anyone. It was in the valley that belongs to Beth-Rehob. Then they rebuilt the city and lived in it, and they named the city Dan, after the name of Dan, their ancestor, who was born to Israel. But the name of the city had been Laish at the first. On the one hand, it sounds like they finally found some land, some territory they could take and hold. And it gives them all the things that they couldn't get down in their allotted territory, right? They wanted to get out to the lowlands. They wanted to get to the arable, farmable land. They wanted to plant crops and vineyards. And you can do a little bit of that in the hill country, but not a lot. The east-west running ridges and valleys of that part of Israel are called the Shephelah. And you can do some stuff on the sides of the slopes, but not like you can out on the plain. But now they've got all of that up there at these headwaters. So they're happy. There's just a couple of problems. They have done one of two things that violates what God has given his people as instruction. And it all depends on where the actual boundaries fall here. If they are actually inside, as this map shows, the territory that was given to East Manasseh, then they have stolen land from their tribal brothers. If they are not inside the boundaries of Manasseh, then Deuteronomy instructs that in a situation like this, where they're attacking a city that is far away, and the thought was not that it was going to be taking the, possessing the land, but more like warfare, but they are instructed to offer peace first. And there's no indication that the Danites did that at all. In fact, it's pretty implicit that they didn't, because they talk about how unsuspecting the people will be. And I'm just looking in my notes for the reference for that, and I know it's here, but I'm not finding it. So what these people from Dan are doing is just as problematic as what the Levite did. It's just as problematic as what Micah did. They've gone and they've taken this territory, this city and its surrounding area that was never part of what God allotted to them to have, that may have been intended for their brothers in Manasseh, or if not, that should have had peace offered but didn't have peace offered. They were just peaceful and unsuspecting and conquered. And we'll end here, because we're so close. We'll just finish the story. And the people of Dan set up the carved images for themselves. And here's the drop. Here's the reveal that the writer has been holding to the end. And Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Moses, and his sons were priests to the tribe of the Danites until the day of the captivity of the land. So they set up Micah's carved image that he made as long as the house of God was at Shiloh. All through this story, this young Levite never had a name. And now here at the end, we find out that he did have a name, and he was Moses' grandson. Wow. Anybody can fall. Anybody can stray. And that's the second reason we think this is early in the history that Judges covers, because Dan had not yet successfully pushed west into their own allotted territory, and because this Levite is the grandson of Moses. That can't have been 300 years later after Samson. That has to have been earlier. But what a story. And that's all there is to it. That is the story. There's not one moral, there's not one building climax that makes everything come into focus and say, this is why this story is here. The point of this story is spread all across the entire two chapters. It is how bad things have gotten in Israel, that a man who lives so close to Shiloh would nevertheless ignore the proper worship of God, that a Levite would buy into it and participate in that same sacrilege, that a tribe that's having trouble doing what God told them to do would just say, oh, let's find a better way and not do it God's way. And steal this Levite and steal all this idolatry and take it with them up north, where they did remain established for the history of, I mean, most of your maps of Israel will show two dams. One down where it was supposed to be and one up here. Nothing went right here. Nothing happened the way it was supposed to. And that is the point of the story. It is an illustration of how bad things had become in Israel. This all could have happened quite quietly, right? Given the environment of the land. And it probably did happen fairly quietly, except for those folks up at Laish. But that just shows how much this corruption had permeated the daily life of God's people. The next story is not so quiet. The next story is pretty vivid and catches everybody's attention all across the land. And if Augie were old enough to understand, I'd say he should not be here next week. But that's next week. We've gone a little late. We need to stop. We'll kind of recap and invite any questions or comments when we get together again next week. But for now, we better pray. Father, maybe the most disturbing thing about this story is that it is just so much like the world we live in today. People don't want to pay attention to your word. Even people who call themselves by your name make excuses for doing things the way they want to do them. We do things that are right in our own eyes, and we don't even necessarily allow ourselves to use the standard of your word to see what we're doing wrong. Grant that we would not be like the people in this story. Help us to see the places where we are shutting you out of our everyday life. Help us to treat our brothers the way we should. Help us to be faithful to you and what we know you've called us to do. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.